People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
You know, men of that age, they laugh and joke about the things, and you might as well do it, huh?
Yeah.
And enjoy it, because... And then sometimes it would get real, real rough.
Man, that was a hot spot, because the Germans had almost pushed us off that beachhead. It was a tense moment, I can tell you that.
We executed him there on the beach by a fire squad.
We were taking on water up in the forward torpedo room. Now, if you got in and straightened up with the log, that's the time you start doing it.
We could just see the Germans running in groups out of those gun emplacements when those big guns were flying right into the side of the hill. And that's really what saved our neck, I guess, or we would have been slaughtered like the 116th Infantry was.
World War II. It's still a vivid memory to many people in our area. This is Monday at 1, a public affairs program of WJMA Radio Orange. I'm Phil Odebear, and welcome. Today's program is called War Stories. We have talked to five area men who all played a role in World War II. Joe Samuels and Tommy Brown actually landed on the beaches of Normandy 38 years ago this past Sunday. They participated in the largest single military operation in the history of mankind, involving as many as a million men. William H.B. Thomas was a bomber pilot. Henry DeJarnett was sweating it out in the jungles of India. Billy Trimmer was sweating it out in a submarine lying on the floor of the Sea of Japan. They all have a story to tell. There are a lot of reasons for this program. For one thing, Memorial Day was celebrated about a week ago. It's a time to remember. For another, this past Sunday was the 38th anniversary of D-Day. And this past December, WJMA aired a program, Monday at 1, that featured eyewitness accounts of the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the beginning of the war. From those interviews came the substance of today's program. But there's another reason for it. Many of us don't know what war is like. In some ways, World War II may be the last conventional large-scale war in the history of mankind. From now on, warfare may be limited to engagements such as the Falkland Islands, or it may slog along in a sort of below-the-beltway like it did in the swamps and jungles of Vietnam. Or there's the other alternative, total destruction by nuclear conflagration. Maybe it's just best to forget about it. Then again, maybe it's best to hear the war stories. For those of us who don't know what the war is like, it's a reminder. It's a reminder not to make the mistakes of the past. It's also a reminder not to become complacent. I'll be back with war stories right after this.
Hi, I'm Holly Halberg with the Virginia Employment Commission, and the following is a listing of applicants who have recently registered with the VEC and who are actively looking for employment. A recent applicant is seeking employment in the area of quality control. The individual has over 13 years' experience as a quality control technician. And a veteran is interested in securing employment as a diesel mechanic. The individual has 9 years' experience as a heavy equipment mechanic and has supervised other mechanics within a shop. For details on these individuals and other qualified workers, contact the Virginia Employment Commission, located in the basement of the Second National Bank in Culpeper, or employers can call us at 825-8117. The Virginia Employment Commission is an equal opportunity employer and service provider, and Applicant Profiles is a cooperative effort of the VEC and Radio Orange.
Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose.
By 1944, Bing Crosby was charming our ears with the songs of the immortal Cole Porter. In some ways, Don't Fence Me In represents the American spirit for freedom. And by June 6, 1944, it was more than apparent to our leaders that in order to stay free, fences had to be put up around the Third Reich. President Franklin Roosevelt announced the invasion to the country.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment the troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home.
One of the thousands of men who was crossing the English Channel that night was Joe Samuels. He was at that time a second lieutenant with the 4th Infantry Division of the 22nd Infantry, a highly trained combat unit that had already been together for several years, and wound up staying together for the whole war. In January of 1944, he was sent to England, near Plymouth, in ultimate preparation for the assault on June 6th.
Frankly, we were on amphibious training all the time, a mock-up of the landing area. Of course, we didn't know where it was, but we had a mock-up of it. Complete in every detail.
So, Joe, you knew way ahead of time that you all at one point were going to land on a beach, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you just didn't know the exact date?
Didn't know the exact date, nor did we know where.
When the time came to move out because of the real thing, did you all have any idea then where?
No. The officers knew probably 24 to 48 hours ahead of the actual invasion. The men did not know until the time we got on the ship.
Can you sort of describe to me the circumstances of leaving England and getting on that amphibious vehicle and going across?
Well, Phil, really, we got on at, I believe it was Torquay. We went into a staging area for 2 days, which was completely enclosed by fence. Nobody could enter or leave.
We got on the ship late in the afternoon and pulled out after dark. At that time, we knew where we were on land. We knew what wave we were in. We knew that the paratroopers were going in ahead of us. We saw the paratroopers and gliders going over at night. Then we got on a landing craft sometime before daylight.
And then you headed on into what beach?
Utah Beach, which was, I reckon that was the southernmost beach of the three beaches that we landed on.
Were you the first wave?
No, I was the third wave.
What was going through your mind when you jumped off that landing craft?
Well, I don't know, Phil. We were pretty well trained. We were ready for it. We thought we could whip anything. The companies were special troops. A company of assault troops was 108 men, if I remember correctly. And every man had a duty, and every man had a pillbox that he was going to get. And I think we thought we were going to have a lot more casualties than we had. It was a sight to see the number of crafts, the airplanes, the bombardment and so forth of the beaches.
Our own ship has just gave its warning whistle, and now the flak is coming up in the sky. Looks like we're going to have a night tonight. Something burning is falling down through the sky and circling down. Maybe a hit plane.
When you hit the beach, did you have a specific assignment?
Yes, yeah.
What was that?
My company was to take the pillboxes immediately in front of it and move to the right. And I think we had only five pillboxes to take.
Only five?
Only five.
That sounds like a lot to me.
We were to, there was sort of a leapfrog action. The next wave was supposed to pass on through us. And then the next wave would come behind that and pass through the second wave and so on. And we had an objective the first day, approximately 10 miles of beach. I reckon we actually got less than a mile of beach. And we didn't get our 10 miles for about 10 days. In fact, on the 10th day, you could look down and still see the landing area where we had landed 10 days prior. So it was a harder job than we anticipated.
Yeah. At what point were you hit?
Well, I was wounded on D-Day. I was wounded again probably 8 or 10 days later. I saw right much service right there.
But you did. So the wounds on D-Day weren't enough to make
no.
you go back?
No. The wound on D-Day was a mine. The wound some 10 days later was a bullet. And luckily, I was not out of action more than enough to go to the aid station.
Wow. Then you were wounded three more times during the war, right? Two more times?
Three more times after that.
Now, this is on the way through France?
Through France and into Germany.
Were you in the Battle of the Bulge?
Yes, yes. I was in that only for about a week or 10 days before I was wounded, and that was the most serious of the wounds. It was a mortar, and then I was sent back to England for approximately a month, 6 weeks. I was moving up really to take command of the battalion because the battalion commander had been wounded, and so I was moving up to take command of the battalion. And a mortar, as you know, It makes no sound as it comes in. And it was a tree burst, which we were being shelled very severely with these mortars. And it was wounding and killing a large number of our troops. But it makes no sound as it comes in. So you can't do much about it. And I was right on top of the ground.
When did you finally get shipped home?
I got shipped home within a month. Let's see, I landed in New York on July the 4th, right after the VE Day. And I was an advanced group going into a staging area for our troops to move on to Japan.
So you went on out to the Pacific Theater, too?
No. See, the war ended before we ever... my company and regiment got in about 2 months after VE Day, and each one of them had 30 days leave. So really, we weren't ready to do anything for about 3 to 4 months after VE Day. So I never got into the Pacific Theater.
Do you still think about the war a lot 40 years later?
No, not really. I mean, I wouldn't want to do it again. I wouldn't have missed it either. I made a lot of friends there. I see them from time to time. In fact, we meet every other year. The regiment meets every other year. And we were a unit that was together for some 4 to 5 years before the war, and everybody knew everybody else and their family. So we are very close.
That's good.
But I don't worry about it. Doesn't bother me at all right time. I probably had visions of it being worse, and some of it was bad, and some of it really was not too terrible. You know, men of that age, they laugh and joke about the things, and you might as well do it, huh?
Yeah.
And enjoy it, because... and then sometimes it would get real, real rough.
What things would give you a little strength when things got real rough?
Well, Phil, I reckon the men around you, certainly religion that you have gave you strength. Training background and so forth gave you strength to keep on going.
Joe Samuels did keep on going. He came home with the Distinguished Service Cross and 5 Purple Hearts.
Into each life, some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart, some tears must fall, but someday the sun will
Orange County historian William H.B. Thomas was above it all. He was a pilot flying bombing runs over Germany.
We're bombing Regensburg in southern Germany, and we had a terrible time. We got the whole group had been shot up by fighters and, of course, hit by flak, and our plane was hit pretty badly. And of course, we kept on going, had an engine out, and finally, late in the day, we were trying to get back to Italy. The whole problem had arisen because my navigator had bailed out in the midst of the excitement. And when he bailed out, all the aeronautical charts went with him. So we didn't have any idea where we were, except we, you know, we headed generally south. And anyhow, came out over the Mediterranean, and it was late in the afternoon, raining, running out of fuel, and the engine was not operating right. Finally, we got down close to Anzio, and I mean, I knew where we were, of course, then, and we saw the star shells and all these things. It was very dramatic, except none too comfortable looking, you know. In the Air Force, we weren't used to all that kind of stuff. So, at any rate, we got right close to it, and the only thing that I could possibly do was to ditch in the water off the beachhead, which was just as well, because the Americans even were starting to shoot at us. They were taking any chances that, you know, it might have been a captured plane, which was, you know, had been turned against us. That had happened. And so anyhow, we ditched, and you know, everything went pretty well. But since there's always an amusing touch to all these things, Why, the one thing there, I asked my engineer for a very pistol. Now, a very pistol is just a little small thing to shoot off flares. And I was going to shoot off the colors of the day, a coded signal, you know, we were friends. And he said, well, I'm sorry, sir, but I threw it overboard to lighten the airplane. He was throwing this little, to lighten this many-ton airplane. So anyhow, we ended up by blinging out SOS and landing lights. But anyway, of course, we ditched all right and got picked up and all that.
Right in the middle of everything.
Right in the middle. And it was right in the middle, too. I'll tell you, they had an air raid going on, and of course, on the beachhead itself, I mean, it was just something else again. And that was the closest, I guess, I actually came to, you know, to infantry action firsthand, as it were. Man, that was a hot spot because the Germans had almost pushed us off that beachhead. It was a tense moment, I can tell you that.
We'll be back with more war stories right after this.
I bought this gadget by mail. The ad said it would save me a lot of gas. It did. Since I put it in, my car won't start.
They said I could make money stuffing envelopes at home. I'd like to give those envelope guys a licking.
If you shop by mail and don't get what you were promised, it could be mail fraud. And there are many different kinds, from products that don't work to worthless work-at-home schemes. If you're a victim or even suspect mail fraud, call your postal inspector. It's his job to keep the mail a nice way to shop.
The ad said I could lose 20 pounds a week painlessly. What I lost was $20, and that hurt a lot.
They said there were hundreds of dollars to be made working at home. They were right. I worked at home, and they made hundreds of dollars.
Remember, most of the time when you shop by mail, you do get what you were promised. But if you suspect mail fraud, call your local post office and ask for your postal inspector or postmaster. Don't take getting taken. A public service announcement by this station and your postal service.
In 1944, Eddie Haywood's rendition of Begin the Bhagwan was a million seller. But somewhere in the steamy jungles of Assam, India, Henry DeJohnette may not have had the ways and means to pick up that tune on the radio. DeJohnette had decided to enlist and had closed up his orange attorney's office. He joined the Judge Advocate General's Department as a young military lawyer. His job during the war was to ensure military discipline, to process claims, and later to investigate war crimes. He wound up on an abandoned tea plantation in northern India.
During the monsoon season, when it would rain an inch a day every day, come hell or high water, as you might say, and then steam the rest of it, rain for about an hour, and then steam the rest of the day.
About how hot?
It would get up around 100. You never dried out. When you wrote anything, you had to wrap a handkerchief around your hand, because the sweat from your hand would make the paper so wet that the ink would just smear all over. Yeah. And you broke out in heat rash, and your clothes mildewed. And
didn't you catch some nasty
diseases?
Yeah,
and you get a little bit of jungle rot.
Yeah. And did you ever catch malaria?
No, we took that Adderall. It made you turn yellow. And I never got malaria. I had a couple of bouts of what they refer to as FUO, being fever of undetermined origin. So it didn't last long, and just, I don't know what it was. Of course, we did have a lot of dysentery, yeah, amoebic dysentery.
Yeah.
And then we'd all have to run over and take tests for all that. But It wasn't too prevalent, but a few of the boys got it.
Now, did you fly the hump or travel the Burma Road?
Yes, I never got all the way over the hump. I tried to. I've had work more schemes that fell flat, but never could get all the way over. I did go up the road quite a way, up past Michinaw. and never got down all the way down to Bamo, but it was, I saw enough of it to just imagine what the rest of it was like.
Well, didn't they used to take trucks, for instance, and cut them in half to load them onto planes?
Yeah, that was part of the job of the operation that we had there, was flying gas and oil for the Air Force, for their airfields in China, that later on they had to destroy when the Japs moved on the ground and chased them out. But also getting trucks in there, transport for the Chinese forces and the American forces over there. And they would take an ambulance or they would take a crane, a construction crane, they cut it in half. They put plates on it, bore all the holes necessary to line things up, then take the plates off, cut the thing in half, put them in the plane, C-47s or C-46s, fly them over, and hope that they could get them put back together. Now, sometimes they would fly one half of the piece of equipment, a bulldozer, say, would go in C-47. Then another piece would take off. They'd send that over a half hour later. Weather would change. One piece would wind up at one airfield, and another piece would wind up at another airfield.
And never did the twain
miles
meet.
Away. And one very funny thing I thought happened. These engineer boys were in charge of cutting up this equipment. And they used to cuss and raise Cain about those knotheads in China that didn't know how to put the stuff back together again after they'd cut it up and given such detailed instructions on how to reassemble it. And then they were sent to China. Then we started getting these radios from them. What knotheads did this, that, and the other, and why don't you all learn to cut this stuff up properly? And we checked back on the records and found out that they'd cut it up themselves.
At one point, you wound up on a slow boat from Australia or something.
Oh, that was getting over there when we left and went out of Los Angeles.
And how long did that journey take?
Took 67 days.
On a ship, never, not, gee.
And we were told, at that time, they figured that the Japs would not send out a submarine wolf pack against single ships, only against convoys. So they did not send us in convoy. They sent us out singly. And they'd send a ship out every day or two and give it a special route to run. And it changed course. It changed its course two or three times a day in its zigs and zags. And any ship that you met anything that you sighted was supposed to be hostile. You presumed that it was hostile. And we were on an old Liberty, chugging along at about between 8 and 9 knots.
Top speed, right?
Top speed.
Flank speed. Wide open.
And went down by the Easter Island somewhere. They were off. We never saw them. We were so far away. And went between New Zealand and Australia, around through the Straits of Tasmania there between Hobart and Australia, on around to Fremantle. And we did stop there for 8 hours.
But that was it.
And then back on the ship, and then on to, we passed by and stopped in the harbor in Ceylon at Trincomalee, and then picked up one of the most dangerous things. We picked up, got in convoy there with a bunch of old island steamers, coal burners, that tore along at 4 knots an hour. And the smoke from those coal burners would go straight up in the air. It looked as though it went up at least 5,000 feet. I never saw such pillars of smoke going up from them.
Saying, here we are.
Any Jap with that part of the hemisphere would have spotted us. But and our protection were two little, what we would classify right here, shrimp boats.
Well, then, when you were in that convoy, didn't you have an experience one night?
Oh, that was interesting. We didn't have too much confidence in these convoy guard, these two shrimp boats, as I call them. But we did say, well, they've got radar ashore, and they'll warn us if anything happens. And then one night, just everything broke loose. You never heard such bells ringing, whistles blowing, people cussing and carrying on. And we went to the rail, and ship would go by, heading in the opposite direction, go by, missing you about 30 or 40 feet on one side, and you'd hear some screeching and yelling on the other side, and another one go by. And we were running right through the middle of a convoy coming down from Calcutta, down to towards Ceylon, and we were going up.
And you went
and
right?
We'd run right through them, and evidently our convoy guard had failed to pick them up on their radar.
And you never had a collision?
No one collided, but it scared the dickens out of all of us.
I'll bet it did.
Obviously, Henry DeJarnett's experiences were filled with humor, but they also had an element of horror, to the point that humor was the only defense. He helped investigate war crimes after the war in the China-Burma-India Theater.
They were the people, primarily those who were in control of the prison camps, the labor camps of for the prisoners of war, the River Kwai group. Yeah. We were closely connected with the and tried the camp commanders for the mistreatment of American, Dutch, Australian, and British and American troops there. Well, and we had an occasional few aviators whose planes had been shot down in France, Indochina, Burma, Malaya, and had been captured. And we tried some of the jail people in heads of the prison, and actually tried the commanding officer of the Japanese forces. We executed him there on the beach by a firing squad, there on the beach at the same place that he had ordered 11 Australians who had been in a flying boat that was shot down. The very place that he had ordered their executions. And the people of Singapore, the natives there, were very, they were looking forward to some such action as that. They were very interested in seeing that happen.
Did you find many people guilty, actually?
Oh, we hanged a few, and that's the only one we shot. He was, because he was a general and had ordered the others shot, they gave him the same dignity.
Yeah.
That was quite an honor to be allowed to be shot rather than hanged.
Yeah. Were you involved in combat experiences in India, Henry?
No, after the war, in the middle of a firefight between Chinese bandits, so-called, on one side, and some Burmese natives on the other, who were fighting over who was going to steal the United States supplies.
And you were in the middle.
Yeah, we were in the middle. We were there with the claims team, inspecting and investigating claims, and ran into the middle of this little skirmish between the two forces. And that was the only real scares I ever had.
Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down. Oh, drinking beer in a cabaret, was I having fun? Until one night she caught me right, now I'm on the run.
Oh, lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down.
pistol packing mama and lay that pistol down.
Tommy Brown of Grimes Drugstore reported for duty in March of 1942. He had already been rejected once, but was determined, and he proved his worth on a forced training march with full pack. Around October of 1943, Tommy was with Company A, 29th Division of the 115th Infantry, standing on the docks of New York City.
Aboard the Queen Elizabeth, biggest ship in the world at that time, I guess, and they had converted it to a troop ship. And we sailed on the 4th of October, I believe, going to England. And about the fourth night out, we heard the Axis sally say that the Queen Elizabeth had been bombed in the middle Atlantic, loaded with troops, headed for England. But we knew the night before that a sub was after us because the ship kept changing directions. But she reported that we had been sunk.
She was the radio announcer, right?
Right, Axis Sally. She was a propaganda girl for the German troops. But we were still sailing very smoothly that night after she said we had been sunk. And we landed in Greenock, Scotland on the 7th, I believe, of October. And then I spent 22 months in England before going to France on D-Day.
How was that stay in England? Did you enjoy that?
Yes, it was a lot of hard training, a lot of amphibious training and on the English Channel, and we did a lot of outdoor in the moors of England, if you know what they are. It's a rough country. And we stayed wet a lot of days and a lot of nights without any dry clothes. But I enjoyed my stay in England, really. I got to know a lot of people, and I enjoyed my stay in England.
Then, was it June 6th of 1944 that you took the boat across? And where did you land?
I landed on Omaha Beach.
What was going on as you got off that amphibious vehicle?
Well, Phil, I was in the second wave. Our unit followed the 116th Infantry in, and it was supposed to be D+3. And we were supposed to relieve Company A-116th. And we were told that only 6 men of that company survived. So we really went in not to relieve anybody. We went in fighting. And the Germans still were zeroing in on the beach with the 88-millimeter guns. And I guess we were lucky to get off of there. The two big battleships out in the channel turned broadside and fired those big 21-inch guns right into the bank off the beach, and I think that's really what saved our hides, because we could just see the Germans running in groups out of those gun emplacements when those big guns were firing right into the side of the hill. And that's really what saved our neck, I guess, or we would have been slaughtered like the 116th Infantry was.
Were you hit when you got on the beach?
No, I didn't get wounded until the first attack on St. Lowell. That's
a little further inland, right?
I noticed that the newspaper said I was wounded D-Day at St. Lowell, but that's a big difference. D-Day in St. Lowell was further inland quite a bit.
What were the circumstances of the St. Lowell thing?
Well, the city itself, all I know about that is what I read. See, I never did get into the city. I was wounded on the first attack, and then our troops backed up and regrouped, and I really never did get into the city. But from all reports and from my buddies that I've talked to since then, it was not a building standing in the city. We were crossing this field and going into a patch of woods, and I was an assistant machine gunner, and the snipers in the trees were just picking us off. So we had to back off and go around. You've heard of the hedgerows, the stone fences they call hedgerows. And we backed out of the field and went around the edge of the field crawling behind the fence until we could get our machine gun set up in an anti-aircraft position. And we just emptied a whole belt of ammunition right into the top of the trees. And after that, the rest of the rifle troops didn't seem to have much trouble crossing the field. But after we got in the woods, we had missed a couple of three snipers, and then they opened fire on us after we got in the woods. And that's, I was hit by a German machine pistol. That's a big pistol with a folding stock on it that you can use as a pistol or a shoulder weapon. And I was hit twice in the upper right arm and in the shoulder, and almost lost the arm. But, the arm from the shoulder to the elbow was shattered, and I was 10 months recuperating. But thankful to be here anyway.
Meanwhile, another area man was halfway around the globe from the European theater. Billy Trimmer was an electrician aboard the USS Pennsylvania in Pearl Harbor when the Japanese struck on December 7, 1941. Later, he wound up on the submarine Ratfish, which wound up sinking 123,000 tons of enemy shipping.
Pearl Harbor was something I'll never forget, but the day I remember most in my naval career was December 19, 1944, when we were in the Sea of Japan, which is between China and Japan, and we sunk a large 29,000-ton carrier, the last big one that the Japanese had, and it had three destroyers with them. And since we sunk the only thing they were escorting, they could devote their full time to us. And they worked us over pretty severely, because the water in the Sea of Japan is not very deep. And they caught us in 230 feet of water and kept us down there about 4 or 5 hours just dropping depth charges as hard as they could drop them. And when we got ready, we hit the bottom. And we just shut off everything because they had broken up the boat pretty bad. We were taking water in the forward torpedo room. And they really worked us over, and we got ready to leave it. We took it about 4 or 5 hours there. And the captain decided we'd try to get out. It got dark about 9 o'clock. We decided we'd try to get out because they had us zeroed in, and there was just no getting out of there. And we could hear them get back, and you'd hear silence, and then you'd hear this chip, 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 chip. That was the screws going over the top of the submarine. And then you'd hear this, all these depth charges. They'd throw off about 8 or 10 of them at a time. And so he said, we got to get out of there. So when we got ready to go, though, this depth charging in this 1,800-ton submarine, laying there like a wounded animal, you know, we tried to get up and go. We had created a suction in the mud. And so when we blew our main ballast tank, we couldn't get up. We were stuck in the mud. And we were taking on water up in the forward torpedo room. And now, if you got in and straightened up with the log, that's the time you start doing it. When we couldn't get out of this mud that we were stuck in. And so we kept fooling around there and shifting the boat back and forth, back and back and forth. And we finally got out of there. And when we surfaced, we were 900 yards from those destroyers out there, and they were still depth charging. And, but we, at night, you can't see a submarine on the surface at night. Mm-hmm. We ran and got away that way. But we took a terrific beating. That was just one of many that that submarine took.
We'll be back with more war stories right after this.
The next time someone comes to see you, give them a chance to see Virginia, too. After all, there are sights around every corner that people come from around the world to see. Places famous in history, like elegant presidential homes, picturesque towns from centuries past, romantic old plantations, and dramatic battlefields. There are the legendary Blue Ridge Mountains with their breathtaking scenery and glittering caverns. There are wide, warm, wonderful beaches, thrilling theme parks, places to visit just for the fun of it. Isn't it exciting that the best place to visit in all America also happens to be the place you live? Virginia. This year, share it with someone you love.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Monday at One. We call our program today War Stories. We've heard from local people who landed on the Normandy beaches 38 years ago this week. We've heard from a man who piloted a bomber, another man in the jungles of India, another who spent part of World War II on the bottom of the ocean in a submarine. All of them made it home to tell about it. There were many that didn't. But it was not in vain. The war started to shut down. First, in Europe.
We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States, and other countries, and her detestable cruelties, call for justice and retribution.
The voice, naturally, of Winston Churchill. The retribution came swiftly with the first, and so far, the last use of atomic weapons. It quickly led to this announcement from a reporter at the White House.
7 p.m. Eastern Wartime, Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. The United Nations are united and are victorious.
With that, the war was over. And as time has a habit of doing, the memories started to fade. But for at least five area men, they are still vivid, even 40 years later. That's our Monday at One program for today. It was called War Stories, and if you'd like a copy, write WJMA, Box 271, Orange, Virginia, 22960, and include $7.50. We'd be happy to provide you with your own copy of this program. We hope you have enjoyed it. It has been another chapter in WJMA's efforts to preserve history on tape. I'm Phil Odebear, and this is WJMA.
These proceedings are closed.